session number 10776. Reel 1.
Dr. Pat Rawlins, Reel 1. So could I ask you first of all then, Pat, about your background before World War II? Whereabouts were you sort of born and brought up?
Well, I was born in Wimbledon, of all places, SW19, right on Wimbledon Common. I consider myself one of the original Wombles. But we didn't live very long at Wimbledon. We moved to Kingston after that, and I went to a little local school in Kingston, and then, for my sins, I was sent to Cheam School, which was then at Cheam, and later, just after I left there, the Duke of Edinburgh went there too. The Duke of Medina was there with me. And then, after Cheam, I went to Canford, which was then a very new school down in, it's quite well known now in Dorset. It was a sister school of Stowe. And I was actually, there were three of us, but we were the first ever to take our first MB from Canford School. They even built a sort of wooden hut for our biology laboratory. There was nothing down there at all then. And so, actually, of course, inevitably, I failed my first MB from school. I took it. I then went to St. Thomas's, and of course, we were living at Kingston, so it was okay and easy for me to go up. My father had an office in Westminster. So we used to travel by car. We had an ancient Austin 7. We scrummed into this and went up every day. He went to Westminster High, to St. Thomas's. And I had a bit of a struggle with first MB because I was never any good at maths. That was my chief problem, really. And the maths, I had to have that for physics. And, I finally got first MB, got my second. I took three shots at first MB, two shots at the second, and got my finals first time. And, of course, by that time, the war had started. I qualified in 1940. We had this sort of phony war period when the senior students were evacuated out to various hospitals to act as stretcher bearers for the threatened Blitz. And, of course, as it never turned, I was sent to the Battersea General Hospital, had a very sort of slack time there. And then, when nothing happened, we went back to our studies at our various medical schools. I went back to St. Thomas's and back to normal life again.
Before I go on to the sort of war period, could I ask, you know, going back to your sort of the period of growing up, were you aware of the feelings of pacifism when these developed?
Oh, no. No, I was in rather a militaristic family. My mother was a daughter of a colonel in the Scots, wait a minute, the Scots Greys. it wasn't until I was fairly early in my Thomas's career, actually, I became very friendly with a chap called Robin Williamson, who was of great influence in my life. Actually, sadly, he died in his 50s of coronary trouble. But he was then a member of the Peace Pledge Union, I gradually sort of came over to his way of thinking, and I had many a battle with my mother, particularly. I could remember her thumping the table saying, "I'm glad I'm British. I thank God I'm British." And I used to say, you know, during the rise of Hitler, and I it was crazy when you come to think of it in a sense that we were all sort of making excuses for Hitler, including Neville Chamberlain, I suppose, as well, at the time of Munich, and sort of thinking that we couldn't go to war, even with Hitler, you see. And if he, anyway, I had several battles until, let's see, I didn't actually get You see, I was in a reserved occupation as a student, and I think that I had started my first hospital job when I was actually called up. I was then... I can't honestly remember the date, because it might have been when I was still a student, it might have been after I qualified, but I went along down to Kingston, somewhere in Kingston, where they were recruiting, and I said I wanted to register as a CO, and the chap looked at me and he said, "What, big fella like you, you make a fine Grenadier Guard." I said, no, I got to register as a CO, and I went home, and I remember they were having a meal at home, and there was a very ancient great aunt of mine staying there at the time, and I said, rather shamefacedly, "I've registered as a conscientious objector," and they looked at me askance, and this dear old great aunt said, "Well, as a doctor, I don't see that you could do anything else." And wasn't she marvellous? And so anyway, that sort of helped, and then...
Was it important for you, that somebody did give you a bit of support?
Well, it sort of thawed the situation out. I don't know what my parents would have said if old Aunt Bailey, as we called her, hadn't said that. So, anyway, I then came, of course, inevitably to the tribunal. I had to write a long thing. I wrote pages and pages worth. In now looking back, I could have said it all in about one paragraph, really. So I had to explain why it was that I wouldn't go into the RAMC, and I remember saying, well, I considered that the RAMC was as much a part of the war machine as the Guards or any other thing. The net result was that I was certainly qualified by that time, because they said, right, well, you will allocate you to work in hospitals in this country, and you've got to stick to hospital jobs, which, of course, fitted fine with my career anyway, because that's what I would have normally done. Then I had by then already started as house surgeon at the Royal Hospital Richmond, where we had some rather exciting times with the onset of the Battle of Britain, and I can remember June the 12th, I think it was 1940, when incendiary bombs and Spitfires and Hurricanes and Junkers and Heinkels were all sort of milling around above us while we were operating on the top floor with just the glass over the top of us there. And that happened to be my parents' silver wedding. And I was supposed to ride home on my bike through Richmond Park after this operating list for a little party. And I rode on my bike up to the gates of Richmond Park, they were closed just like that right in front of me, and that was the end of any civilian access to Richmond Park after that until the end of the war. So anyway, that's another story altogether, that side of things. So I stayed on. I had 2 years at the Royal Hospital Richmond, and then I left there and switched over to a more senior job at King Edward Hospital Ealing, which I enjoyed very much. I had enormous responsibilities there. I was a sort of senior casualty officer, and more or less did some high-powered emergency orthopaedic surgery there, you know, setting fractures and things like that, and things which no houseman wouldn't dream of letting a fairly recently qualified houseman do. You know, you'd have to have your FOCS and so on. So it was a wonderful experience then.
Would these have been, Blitz casualties?
Some were. Others were particularly police. We had a number of casualties among police and dispatch riders and people like coming off motorbikes and things like that. And then, of course, I think it would have been in November of 1942, we had one hell of a blitz all round there, and we had... even at, of course, at Richmond, we had a number of bad blitz cases. They bombed a big block of flats at Sheen, for instance, and we had 40 or 50 casualties in from that. And then on that night in Ealing, they were most incendiaries. The whole of Ealing was up in flames, you know, and all around that district. And we had the whole hospital just filled, you know. And it was very hairy. You used to hear the bombers. Well, of course, we were supposed to sleep in the basement. And after a while, I don't know, everybody just sort of got fed up with that. And we went and parked upstairs, right in the top of the hospital in our rooms, and you could hear the Jerry bombers coming over, woo, 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 like this, and you could hear boing and shake, you know. And, you know, you just said, well, if it's got your name on it, doesn't matter where you are, whether you're in the basement or on the top floor, so you might as well sleep in your own bed. That was a sort of approach, you know. And
during the raids, you know, would it be the case that you were still on duty, that you had to stay with patients in the wards?
Oh, yes, we were on duty all the time, yes. Mind you, we had off-duty times, and as I said, I was able to ride off on my bike to my parents. That was at Richmond, but... We tried to keep off-duty times and so on, and... It was very much, very intermittent, the Blitz. You know, it depended where they went. The Blitz was going on the whole time, but they, for some reason or other, one night chose to... I think they were after the HMV factory at Hayes, which had turned over to making gliders, you see, from... The people who made the lovely cabinets for the big radiograms of those days were making these Horsa gliders, you see, which were used ultimately at D-Day. And we got a lot of terrible casualties from there, just people who didn't know how to operate the machinery, you know, so on. So I think that was the sort of target they were after, which was all around the place. They're quite big factories which had been converted to war production of one kind and another.
How many COs were working in your hospital?
Oh, none at all. I was in. Oh, well, apart from Robin Williamson, who he and I sort of did our first few jobs together, first job anyway, I should say, and we both qualified about the same time. And after I'd gone to the Royal Hospital, Richmond, he came along and joined me there. And then my third friend, who was he wasn't a CO, though. The three of us from St Thomas's all had jobs together there, actually.
Did the other staff know that you were a Conchie?
I didn't make all that much of that, but I was very much a... what I suppose I might call a preaching Christian in those days, and I think my reputation went rather for that. I got at Richmond, I got very mixed up with the local Baptist church there, although I wasn't a Baptist, I was put under considerable pressure to go into the waters, but somehow I never did. And, you know, I would get up on a Sunday and sort of do a bit of gospelising and this kind of thing. But, as I got older, quite quickly it happened, really, that the more I thought about it, the more I felt, you know, it's no good you talking like this unless you know you can carry out your own, practice what you preach, you know. And I felt more and more that my... calling, if such there was more to serving rather than speaking. So I gave up that sort of thing. And that was at Richmond. When I went to Ealing, of course, I think they knew I was a CO. I didn't sort of advertise it, really. I was always rather shy, actually.
Did you ever experience any sort of hostility
no,
from anyone?
No. Oh, no.
I was wondering also, you know, was your pacifism, was it connected with your feelings about religion?
Oh, I think so, yes. Oh, rather, yes. Mm. Yes, in fact, I think that was my, the pages of my, can't remember what you had to call it for your, what you wrote out for the tribunal. Can you remember?
Was it the statement?
Statement, that's right. Well, that was mostly that was sort of quotes from the Bible and so on, you know. I should think a lot of it was. Okay. Oh, yes, it was very much, I felt that was the teaching of Jesus and that to love and forgive and not to render an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but be willing to forgive. And
yes, and it's interesting, I think, your attitude, because I suppose the RAMC would have been an outlet in a way. Where did you draw the line there?
Difficult to remember now, I think the great majority of medical conscientious objectors, and medical in other things, went into the RAMC. That was considered to be all right. But, I felt that the RAMC was as much part of the war machine as any other regiment, and that if the RAMC, for instance, all backed out, the whole war machine would collapse. Possibly wouldn't, I don't suppose I was right, but, I felt that it was part of... I remember that was what... Those were the actual words, part of the war machine. So that's as near as I can recollect now.
And before we get on to your going into the FAU, Pat, mm-hmm. Going back to the sort of interwar period, you mentioned Hitler, you know, and these
felt
people had towards Hitler. I was wondering how you reacted to things like the Italian move into Abyssinia and the German move into the Rhineland and the Sudetenland. Did that sort of worry you? Did you begin to see dilemmas?
I did, yes. But I don't think they worried me all that much. I think the reason for that was that I was just concentrating on getting qualified. I didn't really get myself involved in politics and I didn't think about it very much. It was more religion and getting stuck into my work and getting qualified. And I think for that reason I didn't get very stewed up over politics. Perhaps I should have done. But,
found events such as Dunkirk or the invasions scare, did that upset you at all, your sort of feelings of pacifism?
I was... no, not really, because, again, work took over there as I was actually taking my finals the whole of Dunkirk time. And, I just finished, I think, just at the time. And I remember I did my bicycle up, painted the mudguards white, which you had to do, and rode it off to see an uncle in Cambridge. Right in the middle of Dunkirk on all that lovely weather, which I can remember so well. And you could hear the guns booming. I think I was too young to... No, those things didn't sort of seem to... Perhaps I was very insensitive or something. I was too full of life, really, to worry too much about it. But, no, I can't say really that it did upset me, if that was what your question was. But, of course, we just had to accept things as they came along, I think.
So could I ask you now about the FAU? You know, why did you leave your hospital work for the FAU?
Ah, well, then, you see, I'd done the 2 years at Richmond and a year at Ealing, and then there was very little happening in the way of the Blitz and sort of and casualty work. Then things settled down to a rather humdrum nature, and I don't know. I suppose one of the things was really that in the back of my mind I'd had a great conflict going on about being a missionary. There was a lot of missionary people certainly in my mother's family, and I always felt that I'd perhaps been called to be a missionary. I was always under the sort of thing, and then for some reason I sort of hankered after going abroad, and I thought possibly the opportunity might come to find out whether I really was destined to be a missionary. And then I suppose I'd heard, I can't just remember now how I heard of the FAU, probably through Robin Williamson, anyway, I seem to know about it, and one off-duty afternoon I just took myself along to Euston Road, you see, and said, with the idea of sort of finding out, you see. Well, that's how it just happened. I went along, and I think it was one of the Cadbury family who was at the reception there, and I said that I was just inquiring about going abroad with the FAU, and I explained, of course, that I had been ordered to stay in civilian hospital work, they looked at me and they said, what about China? I hadn't thought anything like this, because I thought, well, possibly India or somewhere like that. And they said, well, we've just had an urgent request for 3 medical teams to go to China. We've got 2 doctors and 2 teams. We need another doctor. What about you? And I sort of nearly fell through the floor. I never dreamed of anything. Yeah. I was absolutely staggered about this, because I'd never dreamed of actually going to China. I just had to decide on the spur of the moment. I think I said, all right, like that. I'll go. I certainly didn't sort of go home and chew it over or anything like that. Probably within that half hour or so, I'd said, right, you know, the attitude had always been sort of go anywhere, do anything, which was rather a motto of the FAU. It was very much a sudden decision like that.
China was a long way off then, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, I hadn't dreamed of it, really, and I didn't know how you got there or anything. And then they explained, of course, what it involved, and I thought, well, this sounds good. I think it appealed to my
sense of adventure. Did you have to apply to any authority?
Then I had to go back to the Ministry of Labour and say that I had applied for this, and I expect that they had to put in an equivalent thing to say that I had, and that they were accepting me subject to their approval.
Yes. So did you have special training?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, we had... let me see now. As soon as I got the permission through, I'm now coming to I think it must have been the early part of 1943, because I had to finish my job at Ealing, and then I was given, I was billeted in the Middlesex Hospital, and that was where we started our training. And during that, well, we had 6 months, and I finally sailed in November of 43, so this must have been sort of February, March, something like that, when I went into residence in the Middlesex Hospital, and we had training. We went to the Oriental School of Oriental Studies, was it, for Chinese lessons. We went to the School of Tropical Medicine for tropical medicine under Sir Patrick Manson Barr, who was an absolute old, amazing old boy. Those were the main things while we were at the Middlesex Hospital. I seem to remember we had a Czechoslovakian professor of Oriental Studies teaching us Chinese. And we used, of course, the... what was it called? The has been... It was... whatever. Romance. Guoyu Romance. That was the... It was an extraordinary one, but it became, of course, associated with the Chiang Kai-shek regime, so it was never adopted by Mao and the later regime, who adopted Pinyin, you see. But really, the Guoyu Romance was a very cleverly done thing, because you actually included the tones, the Chinese tones, in the spelling. And the third tone, I would remember, you had a double in the middle, which made it a wall like this, you see. And then the first tone, I think it was a sharp falling one, you had a double consonant at the end, you see. So we went jam. I can remember my first, the first sentence in the book, Wo Zong Wo Di Yi Zi Jiang Qi Lai. It was all included. I, from my chair, stand, rise, come, Jiang Qi Lai. I get up from my chair, and then you went on to say, I went and wrote on the blackboard with a fun bi, which was a pen, a chalk pen, or powder pen, a fun bi, powder pen, a chalk, blackboard chalk. So that was Chinese, and then we had these incredible tropical medicine lessons. It was very interesting, really, because malaria treatment was really going ahead just then. They just worked out palurin, and Sir Patrick Manson Barr was I'm confusing this, because I went back later on, after I came back, as palurin hadn't come in then. It was mepocrine and so on. Anyway, we really did a pretty good study of the sort of things we were going to come up against in China. And, of course, as it turned out, that was particularly helpful to me, because I was doing civilian work rather than army casualty work. And so I was well in by then with all the laboratory tests and that sort of thing, you see. Yeah.